Venerable Amy will be teaching in part from this book, The Book of Joy. There are a few copies in the bookstore if you're interested in getting one. If you're interested in having an amazing experience on many levels, Venerable Amy in May will be leading a pilgrimage to Laodo. It's in the Everest region of the Himalayas in Nepal. Laodo is where Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who's the spiritual director of our mother organization, FPMT, he was born in that area and spent time there. So it's really quite an exciting adventure, and she'll tell you about that. And that's it for now.
Do you need a new floor here?
No.
What do I know?
And if we will turn to page 100 in the Gold Prayer Book, we'll do a requesting mandala. Robbie's right on time. To Venerable Amy requesting the teachings. Saji Puki Chuk Shing Me Tog Tram Ri Rav Ling Shi Ni De Gyan Padi Sangge Jingdu Mikte Uwa Yidro Kunam Dag Jing La Tu Parsho. And I'm sorry, I sent us to the wrong page. We want to be on page 98. Jetsun Lama Dampa Kenam Ki
One. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's lovely to be back here. I'd like to thank Robbie and who I think he's gone. Well, there's Robbie. Yeah, Robbie, thank you so much. Donna, everybody at Kadampa Center, Susan for hosting me, all the people that have made this possible, all the people over the years as well that have made this center flourishing, thriving, to Geshe-la. And so thank you so much for inviting me back. I'm very happy to be back.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. I've just been teaching in countries where I have an interpreter. You know, English isn't the language, and so I was waiting for someone to translate that. I'm like, okay. So, sorry. It's. I think we're speaking the same language here, and you know, it's so much easier in English because just the mannerisms and the flow of the. I teach in a sort of engaging way, so. Yeah, I get on a roll and then I have to pause and then kind of smile nicely while they translate, you know. So it's really nice to be back in my own culture. So thank you. So we're going to look at this weekend the path to joy through the beautiful book, The Path to Joy, the Book of Joy. Thank you. I didn't bring a copy with me, but I knew you had one here. The Book of Joy. If you haven't read this book, I highly recommend it. It's a joyful book, and just from the photo on the back, and you can come up later and have a closer look at this book, and there are some delightful photos throughout. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is friends with Archbishop Desmond Tutu, as you're probably aware, and they had a meeting, part of which, I think, or a lot of it, was in Dharamsala, India, where His Holiness lives. And they were interviewed about joy. These are two phenomenal, unusual individuals, as you know, whose countries have gone through some horrendous ordeals. So the Republic of South Africa, the apartheid situation that Archbishop Desmond Tutu lived through, and the truth and reconciliation work that they did following it to kind of put the country back on its feet. It's not perfect there by any means, but it is very different than when it was under apartheid. And His Holiness the Dalai Lama, as you know, who lost his country, Tibet, in the 50s to the communist Chinese. And so the two of them meeting and being interviewed about how is it that you remain joyful and under the situations you went through. And, you know, so this is a little bit of their formula and what they think about it. And so on the back is, I believe it's in Dharamsala, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu likes to dance. So he's kind of dancing, and you see His Holiness, who, you know, monks and nuns don't really dance, at least not in public. And you see His Holiness kind of play, like that. You see the playfulness of these two beings. And I really think it is a great message for us that through our spiritual practice and spiritual attainments, you can rekindle and rediscover that childlike innocence and wonder that you've had in life, but with maturity and the maturity of fully manifest compassion and wisdom and loving kindness. And then you can act from there. So that's really a lot of what this path is about. So I really love talking about this. So the Book of Joy, you must read it. Please. Well worth it. And another book I'll talk about this weekend, similar to this, is Archbishop Desmond Tutu wrote a book called The Book of Forgiving with his daughter. And there's some phenomenal exercises in there if forgiveness is something that's preventing you from having more joy in your life, because we will talk about that as part of this passage like that. So I find that book also really helpful with some very interesting exercises to do like that. Okay. So let's first just bring us here into the space since some stragglers wandered in. So I think we're all here now. Still straggling. Great. No problem. And it's really nice to let go of the week. We've all probably had busy weeks. Fantastic that you've, and it's difficult. It's a rainy winter night. So just letting go of all that other stuff out there in the cosmos, bringing yourself here into the room, and kind of just, it's really nice when we start meditating a little bit to release yourself from all that agenda of activities. So just slowly let yourself set up in a meditation posture. Whatever's most comfortable for you. And many of you are familiar with meditation. So again, it's perfectly fine to meditate sitting in a chair. Just have your feet straight down so the body's balanced. And feel free if you'd like to place a cushion under your feet, if that helps you. Seated on a cushion on the floor, whichever cross-legged posture works for you, to support your spine being as extended as possible, as if your back is straight. As Lama Zopa Rinpoche last taught us at the Light of the Path retreat, which this center hosts, which I'm so absolutely delighted and grateful to Kadampa Center for doing that, he reviewed this 7-point Varachana posture. It's our normal meditation posture we've heard a bazillion times. And we sometimes, when we hear something that's been repeated again and again, we tune out and stop listening, which is the case with myself. But fortunately, I decided to tune in, and it was like I never heard this posture before. Right. So there's always something new to discover, which is why teachers repeat teachings again and again. Rinpoche said, your sides are long. That was new to me. Think about, so again, she just sat up all of a sudden. Her sides are long. It makes you erect. It makes you really hold that posture in a new way. So we place our palms face up, right palm on the left. The thumbs are actually, this was new to me as well, pressed together. Actually, it's active, keeps you active, and it's right against the body at the level of the navel. The thumbs pressed together, this is what I remember. Rinpoche, in this subtle energy system, Rinpoche said, there's a vein that runs down the palm of your thumbs. Not something you're going to see. This is a subtle energy called a bodhicitta vein. So when you press the thumbs together, it suppresses delusion in your mind. And some of my teachers have said it opens the energy center at the heart chakra. Again, subtle energy system, the wheel at your heart, the chakra at your heart can open, so it's easier to meditate. And again, these are right against the body. So if you see Lama Zopa Rinpoche meditating, his arms are out. His arms stick out. Okay? So we don't like that. We don't feel comfortable when people drop their hands and put them in their lap. Then your shoulders start slouching. You lose a little awake energy. You check. Please check everything that I'm saying this weekend. Check up. How does it relate to me? How does it work in my life? Let me try on what she said the other day, that exercise, and see if it helps my mind. You have to check yourself like that. So the wings stick out, and Rinpoche talks about what these wings, your arms, represent. The right is your method, bodhicitta, compassion. This is our way, our method to get enlightened, the good heart. And the left side is the view, the wisdom realizing emptiness. And you need the right view and the right way to get enlightened. That. So in a sense, they're like wings that help propel the bird to enlightenment. Then we have the head tip slightly forward. So up here, you get a lot of distraction if your head's like that. Down here, a lot of drowsiness. So it's subdued, it's comfortable. You can lightly close your eyes, and they're focused towards the tip of the nose or the floor in the space in front of you. and the lips are lightly together, teeth are slightly apart, and the tongue can be curled to touch the upper palate in the mouth behind the front teeth. 7-point Vairochana posture. Just try your best. And as you allow yourself to settle, allow a normal, natural breath to move through your system. And take a couple of minutes now to help your body relax as much as possible. Being relaxed is really the key to effective meditation. So take a couple minutes to scan your body, checking any places you may be holding tension. And allow your inhalation to open up space in the tension. And allow an exhalation to release that tension, bringing yourself to as comfortable a place as possible. So let's consider for a moment, please consider your reason, your purpose for being here this evening. Perhaps for being interested in attending this program. We would all love to have more joy in our lives, I'm sure. What if it wasn't just about us? And what if we had a bigger purpose that we would love to experience more joy? Could we use it to propel us along a path to full awakening, to becoming fully awakened beings, Buddhas? That's what Buddha means basically in Sanskrit. Because from that place, we're unlimited in how we can best serve all living beings, best help others be joyful, free of suffering. So if that is interesting to you, you'd like to include that in your motivation, please do. And take a moment right now to set that positive motivation. So it's a fantastic activity to create more virtue, more positive seeds in your mind by leading off with a positive motivation rather than just jumping in and engaging in an activity unconsciously as we do most things. This is the way you direct your awareness, particularly in a positive direction that can create happiness for you, more and more happiness for you. So take a moment to set that motivation for this evening and all the activities of the rest of your day. And I'd like you to recall right now the last time, something recent, when you really felt joyful and you felt a lot of joy, just something in the moment, something more deeply in life, you were feeling incredible joy. Place yourself back in that situation as best as you can. As if you're reliving it. And you can go back further in time if you don't have something recent. And I want you to start observing. What are you thinking about in this moment? What particular activities are you engaged in? Is anybody around you? And if so, who's around you? Who's not around you? So just explore a little bit like that, the scene around this joy. And what appears to be creating the joy? And just breathe it in. Let it soak through your whole being, body and mind. Hold on to that feeling that you have as you emerge out of that memory. You can recall that feeling. We'll bring this up tomorrow as well, through this weekend, You can always call it up at any time if you're feeling down or confused. You have this potential to feel and experience this joy. So please relax, and when you're ready, slowly bring yourself back to the room and you can open your eyes. Some people may have been not able to find a situation where they felt the joy. So we'll talk about that too, if that's one of the things going on for you. Some people feel they're not capable of experiencing joy. Okay? So it's simply habit. You're just out of the habit. Okay? So this is a path of a lot of what we're habituating ourselves with. The real meaning of GOM, meditation, habituate or familiarize, as you know, okay? So we're just out of the habit of feeling it. And you can get out of the habit and you start perpetuating activities that pull you away from joy. So we're going to explore more of that tomorrow. Let's look a little bit more at the Book of Joy and the eight pillars of joy. And I like to relate it to the Lam Rim and our particular path as well, and how we can fit that in. So let's just look at exploring what's joy associated with. What's it associated with? We're pretty clear about joy to some degree, but there's a whole list of associations. We have pleasure of the sense faculties. We get joy from that. You smell something really good. Taste something delicious. See something beautiful. So we have all that. We hear nice sounds, and there's some sort of joy from that. I think we understand that. We get joy from amusement. Amusement. I mean, even to the very heart of a deep belly laugh. Really laughing. I had a, and the memory I went back to was this past Christmas. I had the good fortune to, I was teaching overseas and my sister lives in England. And I haven't spent a Christmas with my sister and her family in years. So it was very joyful, I thought. And there was a lot of laughter. I haven't laughed so much in a long time, I realized. And I realized, I've been out of the habit of laughing just due to other circumstances in my life. So that was interesting, thinking, making a determination, I would like more of this. Definitely want to be moving more in that direction. Okay? So that in itself, the determination, changes up your mindset already. You know, when you go back into the situation in the meditation, observe. Okay, you're in a kind of this activity that went on, and you put yourself back in the situation and you have a look around, right? At what other things are around me that made me feel joyful, so that I can construct that in my future going forward. Make sense? Do you understand? You're going to create like, I noticed that the room was like that, or these people make me feel safe. Or some people might feel, I was alone on retreat. That's another joyful time for me. And sometimes nobody's there, but what's the container of that? Can I create more of that? Okay? So here's joy associated with contentment. Contentment. A calmer kind of satisfaction. And I almost find contentment, I think I've talked about this in past classes here, is that deep inner peace that you have when you know you're in sync suddenly with who you are, what you're doing, what kind of work you're doing. You know, there's this, I'm right in the perfect place. Okay. What if we could cultivate that all of the time? Okay. All of the time. Some people do. They're really joyful all of the time. And even when they have problems. We know people like this. So what if you cultivated a thought I'm feeling this way more and more the last couple of years, that I'm always in exactly the perfect place. What if we had that thought? I am always in exactly the perfect place. Okay? This is all about Lama Zopa Rinpoche's transforming problems. Okay? His main practice now that he starts us out with, and he said this is also the antidote, one of the practices Rinpoche recommends for the coronavirus to help. You know, we say, oh, there's terrible things going on the planet, this horrible virus, people are dying. What can I do? Well, I'm not in China. We're far away from China. This is what you do. And it's his main practice, it's very short, transforming a suffering life into happiness, ideally. And it's a short, few-page practice. I do it every morning. And then there's some mantras, if you like, you can add to it. But it's just a scanning meditation on the Lam Rim and then some other verses to kind of orient your mind in a good direction. That helps. That helps. So we've got to think of, sometimes it takes effort. We want to make effort that I'm in the perfect place. So Rinpoche's whole teaching is about transforming problems. So in samsara, there's always problems. That's its nature. We know that. That's life. There's problems. So do you want to constantly be like, oh, problem, get away. Oh, I have a problem. This is horrible. This is horrible. You know, or is it kind of like, okay, there's a problem. Okay. I'll deal with it. My mind's balanced, open, spacious. I can deal with it. You know, without any instability in the mind. Without any cringing and fear and anxiety and depression and lashing out at people and folding in on yourself and blaming yourself and blaming others. And who needs that? That doesn't help the problems. Okay, so imagine being in that thing. I'm in the perfect place at any given time. Because when we have a problem, it's perfect because I can learn from it. I can transform something, you know, that transforms my mind into being more expansive, so better able to deal with problems in the future. That's all about Lama Zopa Rinpoche. That's his teaching, right? That's his teaching for his students. So contentment. When can I find that mesh with that inner contentment? Find that joy. And there are people I know with horrendous problems, and they're completely balanced, fine, no problem. And mostly what I've noticed about these people with this contentment is they're just focused on others, thinking about others all the time. The heart of bodhicitta. Okay? Bodhicitta, the enlightened attitude, as many of you know. Bodhi is enlightenment. Citta is mind, Sanskrit word. The mind of enlightenment is all about cherishing others more than yourself. Getting enlightened to perfectly serve all living beings like that. Then you have deep contentment. That's the source of my contentment, I think, having that motivation. It's really the source of my contentment. When I'm not content and I get off the track, usually if I check and observe, as I said before, observe your mind, I'm thinking about myself. It's about my agenda. What I need. What I want. You know. Okay? Another thing joy is associated with, excitement. Okay? Excitement in response to novelty or challenge. Sometimes we have this like, great, I'm actually excited at my commercial advertisement. Sorry. Where is it? I know it's here. Here it is. Okay. It's too far for some of you to see. This is the view from Laudo. Oh, look at that. Thank you. This is the view. This is what it looks like when you stand and look out. It's pretty extraordinary. This is a place, a remote retreat center in the Mount Everest region of Nepal, as Donna mentioned, where Lama Zopa Rinpoche, there's a small cave where Rinpoche is said to have gotten enlightened in his last lifetime. When he was not a monk, he was a merchant. He had tuberculosis. He couldn't trade anymore. He was married. He had a couple kids. And he ended up in this cave and gained very high realizations, they say. And Laudo has been built around the cave. And it's now a small farm, and there's a beautiful gompa and retreat cabins. And I've been going up there for years, done a lot of retreats up there. And Rinpoche has some special projects. They had a lot of earthquake damage, but a lot of that is fixed. But there's some special projects, as well as building more cabins. And Rinpoche has encouraged a few of us with connection to Lauto to try to go up and teach and bring people up there to fundraise, to raise money for some of the projects. So we went a year and a half ago. I brought up a group, and we had an incredible group, an incredible time. And honestly, for me, I've been up there many times and led pilgrimages elsewhere. Somehow the connection of the holy place, we did a three-day retreat there, and many of the people weren't Buddhist, but they all participated in the retreat. It was optional, but they all wanted to do the retreat. And it's connecting people with this place that's been very sacred for me. It became, was one of the richest things I've done in this life. I was over the top with joy over the retreat and the pilgrimage and how well it went and what troopers everybody was, because it's very high and difficult to get up there. So please join us. It's in May coming up, but you do need to register now because there's a process of registration, and we send you some screening questions. There's some medical forms. We want you to be safe and happy and healthy. So if you're interested, I can give you more information. You must go. It's really, it will light you up and make you very joyful like that. So we're going to go in May. Thank you. So I'm excited now. I have the joy of excitement around this. Like, okay, great, you know. And now I'm also happy because I've already led one pilgrimage there. And I'm okay to get myself up the mountain with one or two people, but I never took 23 up with me. And I was worried. In the beginning, I was a little nervous because I was like, I hope they're going to make it. And are they going to get sick? And are people going to be okay with the altitude? And now that we've done it once and I could see the whole container around it, I feel better. And now I'm more in the excitement phase. Okay. There's also joy associated with relief, following upon another emotion where you have some fear, some anxiety. Okay? And so that was a situation. Is once we finished the pilgrimage and all that was gone, I had this joy from the relief. I'm so glad we did it. And it worked. It went really well. I had a good feeling about it. We had the blessing of Rinpoche, and we went and did it. So you understand that joy of relief sometimes when a major exam is over, a major endeavor has passed, the horrible meeting you were dreading, you have enough money for the mortgage and you were worried you wouldn't, the medical appointment and the relief, like that. There's joy associated with wonder before something astonishing, something admirable is showing itself to you. And you have this kind of like, amazing. So we often get this contagiousness, I notice, with acts of compassion. When you see somebody sacrificing themselves, and I thought of, for in some ways, the Australian fires recently, and the firefighters, what they're facing, and they go in there, and I have a lot of awe and admiration for people like that, first responders, how they're. My brother does EMT work as a volunteer with my nephew, And I just think, and sometimes he'd tell me, and I'm like, so what did you do when you showed up and you thought there was a gas leak and people were emptying from the building and you were outside and like what, like, and I'm just amazed at all the, I'm sure he's saved many, many lives over the years like that. So you have a joy from that. There's also joy from ecstasy or bliss, as we know, which can transport you outside yourself. Outside yourself. You know, when you might say to a friend, oh, are we having a moment? You know those moments where you're not so focused so much on yourself, but you're having this incredible sense of well-being, like that. Incredible sense of well-being and that. There's also joy associated with exaltation, where you've accomplished something really difficult or daring. Joy from exaltation. You have a joy from radiant pride, I would say. This is different than a pride that is one of the six root delusions, a puffed up notion of yourself. It's not that kind of pride. You have joy when your kid got into the university that you wanted, and when they get a good grade and when they accomplish something. You have joy when your partner got the raise that they wanted and the commendation at their job, like that. That kind of radiant joy. Radiant pride gives you joy, brings you joy. There's also unhealthy stuff from joy. You have joy, and this is more of unhealthy mindsets, okay? There's a jubilation in noting somebody else's suffering, okay? There is a joy that some people have associated with that. The way I sometimes notice it is if you're driving on an interstate, like a big road, and there's an accident. And people, we have this expression, rubberneckers, okay? You have to slow down to look. What do you want to see? A dead body? Do you want to see somebody's severed arm at the accident? I never quite get, I mean, it's one thing to look, can we help? Like I was with a friend that was a doctor once, we were driving and there was an accident and we pulled over because he thought maybe he could help. Like that. That's different. But sometimes, you know, you see people run down the street, the house is on fire, their neighbor's house is on fire, and everybody gathers outside to watch. It's not that they're joyous about it, but there's this, some people really get off on stuff like that, somebody's suffering. So that's not really where we're headed, but there is sometimes, some people have a jubilation like that. The good joys, here's another one, elevation, the joy of elevation. Having witnessed an act of kindness, generosity, or compassion. So you see that, and then you're lifted up by it, by watching it. Which I love those experiences. You know, I see something, and I'm like, God, you know, I thought about that with the firefighters, or you see somebody save somebody, or, you know, you're transported. And then there's wonderful joy. We've talked about this in past classes, gratitude. The joy of gratitude. The appreciation of a selfless act of which one is the beneficiary. You know, when you see somebody's offering something to you, somebody's doing something beautiful, and you just have this immense gratitude. I'm having this interesting experience now living in my parents' house, the house I grew up in. I came back to the East Coast about 11 years ago specifically to care for my parents. My aging parents, so they have now both passed away. My father last year, most recently, and I'm living in the house right now because we don't quite have places for nuns to live at this point in the States. And fortunately, it's a simple house, but it's very comfortable for me. And I really marvel, and I walk around and I thank them constantly. You know, well, thanks, Dad, the shower's so great, and thanks for the heat, and thanks, Mom, for wanting this to be like this in the kitchen, and I just have this gratitude constantly about having a decent place to live like that, that kind of base. Mathieu Ricard, the monk who is also a psychologist, I believe, he's added some other exalted states of joy. Exalted states, rejoicing in someone else's happiness. Okay? Now, rejoicing is one of our main practices, to accumulate positive conditions and plant deep seeds of virtue in your mind. Okay, rejoicing. Somebody is you hear that your friend's going to Hawaii. You want to go to Hawaii. They're going. You're not going. What's your experience? Right? Are we jealous or are we like, fantastic. I would love to go, so I'm so happy for you. Somebody got the job that you wanted. What was that? Sounded like some bird out there going, "Wah!" You know. Someone got the job that you wanted. How do you feel about it? What if it's a friend of yours? Or what if it's just somebody in your office? They got the promotion you wanted. Okay, that's where really the practice comes in. Some people are more prone to jealousy and envy. Okay? All it means is you got a habit of that in your mind. That's all. Habit of that in your mind. As I mentioned before in here, I was not a natural rejoicer. It was just habits of my own karma, but also the way I was raised. Just wasn't a natural rejoicer. I had different influences around me that created that habit in my mind. And I would hear about somebody going to Hawaii, you know. How come they're going? I should be going. So when I heard it from Buddhism, and I heard you have to practice this, if it's not natural in your mind, can you practice it, and would it arise in my mind more? So I tried. Okay, I tried the rejoicing. They're going to Hawaii. This was me in the beginning, honestly. I'm not kidding. I at least got the face in position. The mind wasn't there, but the face was great. You know, I wasn't totally there with it, but I practiced. And I noticed that my face, I'd hear some good fortune for somebody, but I'd note a pang of, like, envy arise, like, I should be doing that. I just note that, but I didn't play with it as much. I didn't activate it. But I had this going, and so I was a little bit more like, okay, all right, great. And then slowly it came over time. And it really did. So now I hear stuff. I notice I naturally rejoice. I hear something good happen, whether I wanted it or not. I might notice, yeah, I'd love to go to Hawaii, but how great that you're going. And I'm really there with it. My whole mind is there. Fantastic. You got a new car, and you got this, and you're taking a trip to such and such. And wonderful. Rejoicing. Another one he says, exalted states of joy, delight or enchantment. Okay? A shining kind of contentment. You know, when you are really in sync with your life and you feel like you're making great meaning in your life and you're clear about what the meaning is, how you want to manifest, what kind of work you'd like to do, how you'd like to be, what sort of qualities you've wanted to develop in yourself, okay? It's a shining kind of contentment that kind of leads to this overall delight, enchantment. It's wonderful. It's really wonderful. And then spiritual radiance, he says, a serene joy born from deep well-being and benevolence. So it's almost like each one of those is built upon the next one, built upon the previous one. Spiritual radiance. And it's very interesting because I think we did this in here a few years ago, if I teach a death and dying course, if we have a weekend, it's great. And sometimes I roll them out over 10 days. We'll do an actual retreat where there's a lot of meditation as well. And I ask people to plan their memorial services or funerals during that 10-day period. But this is something you could be doing right now. Some people are very clear, and the directions are all laid out, so it's easy for the people they leave behind. There's not this guesswork of, I don't know, did she want that? Do you think they want that? Do they want music? Did they want it in a church? Or do they want to be cremated? Or, you know, some people have no idea when they're left behind. Okay. And then the other thing I ask people to do sometimes is to write out their bucket list. Okay, if you're familiar, do you know what a bucket list is? And I think we're in our culture, we pretty much know. It's all those things you want to get to and do before you die. So it's not just traveling and I want to visit this country. It could be something, I want to write a book, I want to skydive, so you have all your to-dos. I want to do all these things, but I ask them to keep a separate list. Okay, what are the qualities you'd like to develop in your mind before you die? And alongside that might be, what are some qualities I'd really like to subdue before I die in my mind? So it's kind of how are we going to be? How would I like to be when I'm dying? So that I have all that taken care of, could I slowly move my way through that now, like that? And so, the book of joy includes a lot of research people have done on joy, from psychologists, scientists, and it's neat, and neurologists, because now the scientific community, as many of you know, they're finding their way to, first of all, acknowledging the benefits of meditation, without a doubt, and they're seeing the positive effects not only on ordinary people like us, but prison populations, countering hostility, anger, hatred, violence. people with illnesses, people with cancer, all kinds of populations, that it's having incredibly beneficial effects on them. So part of the research done, and this is from an Institute of Neuroscience and Psychology, the University of Glasgow, suggests there are only four fundamental emotions, three of which are so-called negative emotions, fear, anger, and sadness. Okay? The only positive one they've noted is joy or happiness. Okay? Now, the other thing that I find interesting with fear, anger, and sadness, as you want to move more into joy, you need to understand your relationship with fear, anger, and sadness. You can't just deny them and suppress them, and I'm not angry, no, I'm... We have to understand them. You yourself have to understand them in your own mind. So we can also talk more about that, and if you have any questions on that, this weekend. So I'm not as focused on that in the weekend course, but we can certainly talk about it. What I find with fear, anger, and sadness, which has been really helpful for me, is noting, I don't know if this is your experience, how anger is the bodyguard to fear and sadness. Okay? So many people I know lash out in their fear and anger. I'm sorry, in their fear and sadness. You know, one woman, very significant, when I lived in California, we had a group that met every week, a Dharma group, and we went through the Lam Rim, but sometimes we got so close that people would bring in their personal things. And one woman came in that evening, and she was furious. She was she wasn't an angry person, but she was so angry. I said, so we let her talk first. And she was driving on this connector road. It connects Santa Cruz, California to San Jose. It's a terrible mountain, winding mountain road that's extremely dangerous. And there have been many fatal accidents on this road. So it's one road. I have a bit of trepidation when I'm on it, and I really take care when I'm on it to, like, you know, in the right lane, going slowly. But nobody goes slowly on the road. That's the problem. So they're trying to pass you, and there's curves. And so she was on that road, and she said it was horrible. And this guy, she said, and she just went off about the guy, the idiot, stupid, ignorant, jerk, about this guy that cut in front of her. And she had a whole territorialness about the road, my lane, he got in my lane, like she had built the road. You need to analyze. It's not your road. I know your taxpayer dollars may have paid for it, but were you on the work crew? Is your name etched into the road, that it's your road? This is how we think about it. So that's false. That's not accurate at all. You have to dismantle these stories you get going in your mind if you want to move towards joy. So here she comes with all of her rage and my road and I did this, and like her car has more authority to have be in lane. Okay, people get in front of you and don't signal. People do that all the time, right? Okay? And we get angry. Have you ever done that? I've done it many times. You've never done it?
Oh, no, I'm saying
yes. Oh, yeah. That's right. I many times have gotten in front of somebody without signaling, and often it's because I didn't know I was in the wrong lane. This is a turn lane that I'm in. I didn't mean to be here. Oops. I'm a human being, by the way, and I make mistakes. Sorry. Who's a perfect driver? So I what happened was the last minute, I wasn't thinking. I just knew I can't go right here. I'm going to end up in Allentown, God forbid, okay? Right? I know that, there's this turnoff to the turnpike in Pennsylvania. You know, you get and you make the wrong turn, and it's, you can't get an exit for like 45 minutes. It's like you're halfway to Allentown. It's really, so I've done it. One time I was like, when am I going to get off this road? Please. I'm late, you know. And so you quickly zip in front of somebody at the last minute, and it's dangerous, and you didn't mean to. People aren't out there trying to cause accidents. They really don't want to do it. But so this is my brother's philosophy. In the Philadelphia area where I live, It's a gritty city, Philadelphia. Let's face it. I love the city, but it's a unique city in the States, I find it. And so my brother, I was driving with him, and I said, aren't you going to take a left soon? And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, are you going to put your signal on? And he goes, no. He goes, no, because then no one will let me in. Right? It's true. People see that, and they pull up. Okay? Well, that's the nature of delusion working. That's only delusion working. That's not Mahayana Buddhist principles. So we don't have to get into that. Please don't practice that if you're a Mahayana Buddhist. That's not Mahayana Buddhist practice. I'm sorry. Mahayana Buddhist practice is, you know, let me slow down 5 miles an hour. Why? Because I can kind of see everything a little bit better. And I see somebody's coming up behind me in the mirror, and they look like they're in a rush. And they're going to probably try to get in front of me because I'm in the passing lane, right? And they're not going to signal anything. So if I go five, why don't I let them go? What's the big deal? Right? These kind of things. So somebody, she came in raging. They got in front of me. And then all of a sudden she stopped and she went, and because she said, I was driving, and I slammed on my brakes, and she went, I was afraid I was going to have an accident. And I'm like, of course. But anger comes out of the bodyguard, shielding, you know, because we really don't want to feel fear and sadness, because that puts us in a vulnerable space, right? And our culture feels like vulnerability is not okay, okay? So I've talked about her before in here, the sociologist Brené Brown. Some people have read her books. Read her books. They put you in a nice mindset, just like the Book of Joy. Brené Brown, she's a sociologist in Texas. She says vulnerability is the birthplace of creativity, innovation, and change. That's very positive, I think. So if you look at fear and sadness and you notice, you know, why don't we just observe what it's like when we're afraid? Just be there and hang with the discomfort. It's uncomfortable. Well, life is uncomfortable sometimes. But if I hang with it a little bit instead of trying to repress it, suppress it, deny it, lash out at somebody because I'm afraid, all those things, you know, then when it shows up again, I'll be more comfortable with it. Because that's what a lot of our practice is, getting comfortable with the uncomfortable. Okay? It's the same thing with sadness. Sometimes we're down. It's natural for the human mind. It's natural for the human mind. So again, if I just acknowledge that and sometimes just be with it. I remember when I was at Vajrapani and the center in California, As a director, you might hold a little bit more weight with the people around the center. And so I would come in to work that day, and we had about 15 people, maybe 9 of whom were staff. But, you know, if the housekeeper wanted to buy a new vacuum, she was going to approach me when she thought I was in a good mood to ask if she could buy a new vacuum. I mean, we do that because it makes sense rather than, you know, somebody not in a good mood and like that. So somehow people would come in, and some days I just, you know, wasn't my old elated self. I was just in a kind of, you know, it was winter and the trees were dripping and it was, you know, and I was had so much work on and, you know, I come in and I remember somebody coming up, staff members, that trying to, oh, you're kind of down to trying to fix it. And I was like, no, it's okay. You know, like, some days it's like this, and another day, tomorrow will be different. My mind will be different. Like, you don't need to fix it. I'm just going to be with it, acknowledge, because then when I'm happy, I have much more gratitude and appreciation for that. But rather than arming myself with anger because I'm feeling a little down, so just notice that. If that's your situation, that anger comes out as the bodyguard to fear and sadness, and interrupts more of the joy that's out there, more of me getting to joy. I wrote a note here. I really like this Tibetan saying. I'm just thinking about, I think things that contribute to joy as well are home and belonging and where you feel comfortable with friends and family and people that make you feel safe. And there's a Tibetan saying, wherever you have friends, that's your country. Wherever you receive love, that's your home. I really like that saying as far as moving into joy. For me, it's so equated with love as well. So how do you create and build, develop more love in your life, in your world? And I feel like that's, you know, the Beatles were right. You know, love is all there is. Like, it seems like that seems to be the answer to so many things right now. If we can exercise that muscle, in a sense. It's not that it's an actual muscle, but I just noticed because we've got a very fragmented scene in our country right now, and a lot of people ask me, because I had worked in politics years ago, it's like a past life, but they ask me, you know, what do you think about this, or what do you think about that, you know, it's happening, and I don't get as admired in it anymore, and I don't actually pay that much attention. I look at the news a little bit during the day, a little bit, that's it. I'm not kind of like having to check again, and you know, you see it doesn't change that much. But I find like the response we really need right now is love. The more we can come from that place with people that seem to be voicing different opinions, and that's fine. But if I come from a loving place, I'm probably better able to really actively listen to what they're saying. When that happens and that gets engaged, active listening, they start to feel heard. You know, and then they start softening of like, oh, you might have a different view, but okay, we can probably talk here. As opposed to me just fostering my opinion, my opinion, my opinion. My opinion's more important. This is what I think. Meaning, this is for all time. No. And you can learn from other people that have opposing views like that, especially if you come from that open-hearted space. Open-hearted space. So the other thing I think that's helpful to acknowledge, and this book mentions a bit, is so in utero, when you're developing, okay, stress and opposition are there, and it's kind of what the baby sometimes needs to develop, in a sense. So if we just understand samsaric reality, samsara, again, Sanskrit word, to turn, to cycle. What are we cycling through? Birth, old age, sickness, death. Birth, old age, sickness, death. All of that is suffering. Okay, so understanding that dynamic, okay, is that's the basis of human nature, that kind of suffering. Buddha nature doesn't have that kind of suffering. It witnesses the suffering, but it doesn't experience it the way we experience it. So if I just understand that kind of dynamic at times, you know, then I can still be joyful even when something really stressful and negative is happening, where you see some people are yanked right down with it and they get angry and fearful and resentful and hostile, and where some people are like, yeah, well, this is the nature of how things go. So I'm going to continue with keeping my loving heart open like that. So it doesn't mean you're celebrating, and I'm still feeling joyful in the face of the Australian fires or the coronavirus. No, but I can still keep my mind more in a positive space and spaciousness, okay, which we need to respond to those things. So can I respond from a spacious, loving place with practical sense? And that's what I think that space of love and keeping the mind in a balanced way contributes to. And then again, what we know is the source of the suffering. What prevents us, what keeps us from joy? Too much self-centered thinking. Okay? But a compassionate concern for others' well-being is the source of happiness. Okay? And I'm going to add, too much self-centered thinking, this quote in the book, too much self-centered thinking. But here's a separate part of that. Too much thinking. Okay? Some of you are ruminators, I'm sure. Okay? People that turn over and over and over and over in the mind. Okay? I used to be that way. Over and over and over. It was exhausting. Especially when it got into a negative phase. It was exhausting. Okay? So I noticed this overthinking. It was simply a habit. Simply a habit. The beginning was observing. Wow. I think a lot. You know, why do I have to think so much about it? It's interesting. This thing happened to both of us, but she seems to have moved on. But I'm back here. Actually, let me check in with her. You know, and I've noticed certain things where, you know, some incident last autumn, I was with my brother and a cousin, and we met for, my cousin came in from overseas, we met for a meal, and then we were talking about something politically very sensitive to my cousin, and I think based on my response, we're posing that there is another view here. That was my comment. There is another view. Didn't go over very well with her. And I felt this, like, in, you know, somehow the sensitivity in her. And my brother's sitting there. And then later, my brother and I were there the rest of the day. And I said something to him about, yeah, that didn't go so well. Or maybe I should have just not said anything. And he said, oh, I really admired that you spoke up. He says, I never feel like there's space to do that. And I said, yeah, I think she was really upset. And he goes, oh, and he never thought about it. He goes, oh, I didn't think it was a big deal. I didn't think, like where I had been thinking, I know something's stewing. And there was something stewing in her. Like it was, like I could clearly feel. But it's interesting how some people let it go. They don't spend their time thinking about that. So what if we can stop thinking? Now, some things need thinking. So you need to weigh what do I need to give some energy to solve something and sort it, take the responsibility, get it into a good place, and then period, end of that. And don't take it on as much. Now, the other thing is sitting in here, some of you in relationships, how many in relationships? Okay, a lot of people. Okay. How many long-term? Like more, yeah, okay, oh, many, okay. What's long-term? 2 years? No, I'm joking. Okay. Long-term relationships. How many straight relationships, male, female? Yeah, a lot of people. Okay. So are you aware that men and women tend to think differently and discuss differently? Okay. I haven't always been a nun. Okay. I had relationships, often with guys. Okay. And the neat thing was the last boyfriend I had was a Dharma person, a wonderful guy. We were very conscious to discuss how we were doing our relationship when we got into negative pockets with it. So that's a way you can grow your relationship. Can you be aware that men and women sometimes communicate differently? So we also learn this in our Buddhist communities, especially the retreat communities that I was serving. And we would have these meetings at Vajrapani. Every single week we had meetings. A staff meeting during the day and then a community meeting in the evening once a week. And there were guys and women, you know, a mix. And I just noticed after hearing the guy's side of, like, women are just talking about it too much and the women saying the guys are never talking about it, you know, and how we found a compromise. So that was really helpful for us. So a way also, I think, in your relationship moving into joy, can you strike the compromise? But the first thing is being aware of what you are doing, how you are being, how you're communicating, you know, and then finding conscious, calm space to discuss it. It was really helpful for me in relationships. It was so helpful for us as a community of Vajrapani. And I've really used those tools since then as well. And I noticed one time during the Vajrapani time, I was visiting a friend and his wife, and they'd been married for many years, and there were things that she wanted to discuss about her work, and I'd see her bring it up over the course of a few days. She'd bring it up, and then he'd go, yeah, I think that's a good idea. But she wanted more discussion, more input from him, but she didn't say that. So she'd bring it up the next day. And by the third day, he snapped at her. I was right there, and he snapped at her, and he said, I thought we solved it. I thought we sorted it, and you're going to do that. Like, what? So then they had a little bit of a fight. You know, then she got upset and she went to her room sulking, and then, and so he said to me, he goes, I thought we talked about it. And I said, yeah, I said, but women sometimes want to review it again. You know, we do. It's the way our minds work. So if I could, and I learned to say that to my boyfriend. Like when he would, so I would say to him, okay, I know I'm going to discuss this thing, and do you have time for me to discuss this right now? He'd go, yeah, and I go, great, thank you so much. So some appreciation, I want to discuss it, and then we'd kind of come to a thing where he'd give me his input, and I go, oh, that's really helpful. And I said, okay, that's great. I want to think about that for a couple of days, so is it okay if I bring it up in a couple of days again before I sort it entirely? And he'd go, yeah, okay. So he knew. Now with him, the way he made decisions is, boom, he made the decision, done. And he'd never have to talk about it again. So I started to understand that, and when he was done with the decision, sometimes I could accept it and go, okay, that's great, we're done. You know? And then there were other times when I'd say, okay, I know you're done with that, but I need to revisit it one more time. Can we do that? Is that okay? And so we just discussed it openly like that. Like, I'm not quite done with that decision. So just name it and go in there and talk about it like that. Can you be conscious enough to do that? I'm not saying that we were so conscious, but we just realized the pitfalls we fell into when we didn't kind of acknowledge that. Like that. Then he would shut down and say, there's nothing wrong. Nothing's wrong. Right? Do you get that from your male partner if you're a woman? And then the woman's overthinking and overtalking it. So then your partner goes, doesn't want to hear anymore. So we just learn that we just do it a little bit differently at times. And I learned also to be more succinct because it went on for too long. We learned that in the community as well, the overprocessing and things. So it was really helpful. Then another thing, and these are kind of preemptors in the Book of Joy, and His Holiness talks about wise selfishness. We don't want to have too much self-centered thinking, okay? But His Holiness would say, if you're really thinking about positive things and you're thinking about how to direct your life into more Dharma activity and how can I structure this and deal with my retirement or my work or the finances and all that, and realizing that I want to make this commitment to do more retreat, and in order to do that, I'll need to do this, this, and this. But isn't that kind of selfish? And then His Holiness will say, if you're directed to maximizing your spiritual life and your spiritual activities so you can benefit all living beings, so you can reach enlightenment to benefit all living beings, then His Holiness says, then be selfish like that. That's really the only kind of selfishness he'd say would be. Because you do realize after a while that in order to really benefit, I have to get out of the mess myself. I have to become a Buddha. And that's going to take some driving yourself to a path, but never, ever losing the motivation. Never losing the motivation like that. So why is selfishness? Foolish selfishness means you just think only of yourself, don't care about others, bully others, exploit others. Okay, in fact, taking care of others, helping others, ultimately is the way to discover your own joy and to have a happy life. So why selfishness? Any questions right now about anything I've been discussing so far? And anything in relation to your own life, your path to joy? Yes.
Hang on one second. If you can wait for the microphone, because we have streamers that want to hear as well. So I'm going to relate a couple of things that you talked about. You had talked about, as the book mentions, there are four fundamental emotions: fear, anger, sadness, and joy. And also relating to...
And that was just according to that study at University of Glasgow.
Right, right.
So, but it does relate. It does seem, you know, something to think about.
That everything distills down to that. And
you can distill it, yeah.
Yeah, according to the study. That's helpful, but at the same time, also having read a lot of Brené Brown, a lot, I was wondering what your thoughts are on developing emotional literacy, not like to dwell on our emotions in a self-centered way, but in order to enable us to more clearly understand our own emotional picture or help us understand other people's emotional picture to gain, you know, clarity and insight and beneficial, you know, information. So I was wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, what is it more beneficial to simplify our emotional landscape or to make it more complex, or what's the balance there?
I mean, I think the word is balance. I think that's the key. So each situation is somewhat individual at times. So some things take a different response. And sometimes simple is fantastic. That's what's needed, especially in the case, and I'll give an example of, in a sense, like, you know, major emotional drama, like drama kings and queens or people that are blowing things up that really are not as big, then I might have a simpler, quieter response to something as opposed to something that needs more delving into. Sometimes something needs more to address it. So I think you have to weigh with your wisdom of how do I want to respond to this thing? How would I like to analyze or delve in here? What's my responsibility in this situation? Does that make sense?
Kind of. I need to think about it a little more. But I was, what I guess I'm searching for, one of the questions that came up as I was, I listened to the book, I didn't read it, but as I was listening.
You listened to the what?
I listened to the Book of Joy.
Uh-huh.
I listened
okay.
to it as an audiobook.
Great.
And one of the things that I was processing, I'm still processing, and probably will be for quite some time, is the idea of like overthinking things and what, sorry, if this is unclear, it's only because I'm
okay.
still working it through.
Sure.
How do we know whether we're stuck in an unhealthy pattern or we just aren't there yet? We
right.
just need more work.
Right. Well, part of the, when we are in what appears to be an unhealthy pattern, it seems that, because I get kind of, you know, sensations all around my body and everything, you know, I'm just like, this is really not going well, you know, and yet, I can sometimes use that to check, you know, quickly in my mind. We're all trying to develop wisdom and compassion on this path. So I'm building and developing over the years, hopefully some wisdom, my little bit of wisdom, just to apply it there to kind of analyze, okay, like I have some life experience that has been in this situation before. I know that if I continue in this track, you know, she's going to be alienated here. They're going to be, you know, so I don't really, I can just be quiet in this situation. Or maybe here I need to intervene. I think it just comes from life experience to know when to, and also how you're feeling. If you're getting all the bells and whistles and this is not safe, this is not a good situation, this is not a safe person, this has happened with this person so many times before and I never feel good. You know, so that's giving you a message. That's giving you a message, if that's helpful. So part of it is, and I'll give you breaking down, let's go back to just basic practice. Practice can be this simple. Is number one is awareness. Number one is you're just observing. I use that word a lot, observe. You know, what's my mind doing in this situation? What's happening in this situation? And, oh, thank you. Thank you so much. That's very kind. Got a little bit here. Thank you. Thank you. Perfect. So, first of all, what's going on? What's happening with my mind? What's, you know, I'm in this, whatever situation is arising. Number one, and you're noting, I think I'm doing pretty well right now. I'm feeling pretty good. I feel joy. I'm enjoying this. It feels comfortable. I like this. Or I'm not liking this. You know, or I'm being really lazy right now. I should really get up off my butt. Or I don't really like what that person is saying right now. It's so rude and abusive. And so we're noting. But a lot of it is my response. How's my mind in the situation? You know, I shouldn't have said the snippy remark. Well, I have really lack of generous thoughts towards this person, or I'm really feeling happy and joyous for them, and I'm really, you know. So if you're liking what's showing up in your mind, that first is observation awareness. If you're liking what's going on, great, continue. Okay? But what happens is if you're seeing something less than positive in your mind, something that prevents me from being joyful, okay? Number two step then is do something different. You have to try something different. You know. Now, it's sometimes if it's the first time I'm trying something different, it's like breaking trail. It's very hard. So you gather up all your resources and your strength kind of psychically, and you think like, I need first determine what is it that I'm going to do or say or think that will be different, and strike out in that direction as best as you can, okay, with compassionate wisdom. You need to have that motivation. Okay, here's step number three. Just reduce to three steps. Okay, if it works, the new direction you're going in, this is step number three. Do it again. That it's as simple as that. Awareness, do something different, do it again. So sometimes it can be that simple, but if you have a ruminating mind, as I mentioned before, and I noticed I was doing that a lot, overthinking. First of all, I noticed it's exhausting. It wasted a lot of time. It made me anxious if it was kind of an anxiety-building thing, or made me sad, or it didn't seem to have a lot of positive springs to it, the ruminating mind. It was, you know, some decision I had to make, but I toss around from this direction, and, you know, and finally it's like maybe make a list and figure out the pros and cons of something. You know, how can I be of the most, I would always ask now, how can I be of the most benefit in that situation? How can I be of the most benefit? Meaning for the most beings. What's the most beneficial way I can be in this decision, this situation, with what's showing up in front of me right now? What's my most beneficial response for the most benefit, for the most beings? And then sort it. Do it. And then period. Put the period at the end. If you have to visualize yourself, done. And that's all. And move on. If you find that you're an overthinker and the ruminating is taking up too much space, try it like that for a little bit. Practice that for a little bit. And see, are you okay? I was okay with not thinking so much. With not tearing everything to shreds a million times and then I'd be vomiting it up with certain people. You know, and some of them I could see, even my dearest friends were like, this again? You want to talk about that again? Didn't we talk about that for like 6 months of last year? And you're still like, you know. So then I learned, I realized maybe that's not a good thing to do. But anyway, we ruminate in many ways, different ways. But just notice for yourself, does it create a happy or joyful mind, or does it disturb your mind? That was the beginning for me, as I realized it was disturbing me and wasn't lending to the joy. Like that. Yes. Is that helpful? Is that helpful? Yeah. Check on Sunday.
I was thinking about reframing and in my mind and how that gives me freedom. I can be all hunkered down on something, and I think, why are you feeling that way? You don't have to do that. Let's see if there's a different way.
And wonderful.
I love being astonished by people who do reframe, and I think, oh, wow, I don't have to do that. They didn't do that.
Yes. You know? I love the word reframing. I use it a lot now. We're going to talk about that when we get into the pillars of joy, the eight pillars of joy. it's something that lends to joy is how you reframe a situation. And you can hear, somebody's take on something that appears. It's not really good or bad. It just, somebody's doing something or it shows up in a certain way or they walk into the meeting or they say something. And now people have two totally different takes on it. So where's your mind? Is it in the gutter? Like, I know some people, they're always negative. It's just a continual state of misery in their minds. They don't have to be that way. You always have a choice. You always have a choice. And again, and I'll say this again and again, choose kindness. Choose love. You always have a choice, and those two are always available for you. But I know people out of habit, what comes up is something else. Negativity, negative judgment, negative criticism. Like, there's somebody I know, and every time I ask them, you know, hi, how's it going? How are you doing? First of all, it starts like that. Okay, it's I'm exhausted. She's always exhausted. It's exhausting being around her. It's like I'm drained. I'm like there's some people that choose suffering, choose misery. So check that. It's amazing, the reframing. I love that. Can always reframe anything. Different ways of, again, based in some practical reality like that. I mean, you say the coronavirus is, it's a serious thing, you know, and yet, like, well, let's hope it doesn't spread to here, you know, and let's hope that there's a solution. And I think on one level, coronavirus, I say, well, I'm really grateful that China is quarantining and trying to evacuate and trying to contain it, because there have been some issues that have gone down in China that they have not done that. So they are kind of trying to get on top of this right now. So I think, well, that's a positive thing. Like that. Okay, let me go on a little bit more here. I'll take some more. And this fits in. I put her there to plant her for this section. This is about some scientists again. Three factors, okay, that seem to have the greatest influence on increasing our happiness, okay? Number one, our ability to reframe our situation more positively. Number two, anybody have a guess what number two is? We spoke about it before a little bit.
Flexibility?
Flexibility could be. I think it's included in a little bit of these. Our ability to experience gratitude. Oh, my goodness. It's so easy. But again, habit. I don't think for years I was very grateful about anything. As a teenager, oh, no. Definitely not. I was like, if they could have a little, the Wicked Witch of the West in a teenage form, that was me, okay? I just, you know, like any teenager, American teenager, oh, gracious. I just got in touch. Well, it's also how you remember yourself, maybe differently. An old high school friend got in touch with me recently. We haven't been in touch in a long time, but she and I, somehow on email, we were emailing back and forth, and we were talking about our ideas of how we were in high school. And I said to her, I just felt like I was really pushy and aggressive, and, you know, and she had her idea about herself that she was, what did she say, confused and lost. And I said, we were all confused and lost. But, you know, you weren't any different than me. And because all of my aggression came from that. And then her memory, she goes, oh, I remember you were really nice, was her memory, you know. And I was like, well, let's talk about that. Like, I was like, I didn't... You know, people have so you do have different ways you remember, but gratitude is so simple, so basic, and it makes you so happy. So here's the third one. Greatest influence, again, on increasing our happiness, our choice to be kind and generous. It's all related to what I've been saying, our choice to be kind and generous. And these are exactly the attitudes from the scientists, the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu in the Book of Joy already mentioned, and they return to these again and again, these standards in the Pillars of Joy over and over, how we reframe something to make it more positive, how you experience gratitude and a choice to be kind and generous. And I think that flexibility, in a sense, I think it's kind of subsumed in those, I would say, to some degree, like that. So with gratitude, and some of you already do this, this is an exercise I'd like you to do in the morning when you wake up, if you can. How many people are doing your gratitude in the morning from past things? How many people are new to my teachings that never heard me teach? Okay, so there's some people here that need to do this exercise, if you like. When you wake up in bed, you're waking up tomorrow morning, please leave yourself a note, because you'll forget to do it, because we don't have the habit yet. If you'd like to do this, leave yourself a note, set an alarm, put a note by the bed where you'll see it. The last resort on the bathroom mirror, if you get up and didn't do it in bed, it's okay. Have your phone have a little thing that dings that tells you. When you wake up, what I have this waking moment, when I realize I'm in my life, the life I have now, and which is pretty extraordinary in an ordinary way. Okay, I'm a pretty ordinary person, but I have this gush of like, oh my goodness, you know, I realize I'm waking up in this life. I get another day of this life. Like I'm still in the Amy life, okay? And I'm kind of like, right now, things are working body and mind. I know that will not always be the case, but for right now, it's still working. So I have this initial 10-second gush of like, oh, like fantastic, great. Okay, and then right then, I start reflecting on gratitude for the positive circumstances of my life. 2 minutes, 1 or 2 minutes. Positive circumstances of your life. You know, whether it's relatively clean air to breathe, relatively clean water to drink, that we take for granted every day. I can turn on the tap in the kitchen. After my times at Laudo, which has been, when I added it up, I'm not exactly sure how many times I've been there, but it's been like 9 or 10 times. And all the retreats I've done, I maybe have spent 2 or 3 years of my life there, I'm guessing. So I still have a little bit of an imprint. When I turn the faucet on in the kitchen at my parents' house, and the water comes out and I can drink it, but I'm still kind of like, a little like, you know, it's so exciting, right? Because you can't do that in Nepal. The water's horribly polluted, and the locals have to boil and filter their water. And then even then, you know, we're not sure. I mean, at Laudo, the water is very good. It's very pure, which is another reason you want to go to Laudo, okay? So I have this gratitude circumstance. You've had decent access to decent public education. You have decent clothes to wear. You have nice food to eat. You wake up in a warm, comfortable bed. There's heat in your house, air conditioning in the summer. You have loving family and friends. Maybe you're employed. Maybe you have enough money to support a living space. You have a vehicle, on and on. You get it. You understand. Okay? 1 or 2 minutes. Please appreciate that. We don't spend enough time appreciating it. It's a good life that we have. I know it's not perfect. Nothing's perfect in samsara, but for the most part, looking at us in this culture, coming here, looking around the room, it's pretty good. Next minute or two. The next minute or two is appreciating my good qualities. So please reflect on your good qualities. This gets a little dicier for people. People go, I don't have any good qualities. Really? Yeah, the fact that you got yourself into the room, this room tonight, I think is a good quality. The fact that you ask a good question, you're trying to be alert, you have interest in meditation, I don't even know you. There's many good qualities I just listed. So you have, again, 1 or 2 minutes breathing it in, letting it really soak through you, body and mind. So every cell is touched, every thought, gratitude. I find it so helpful. And then from there, you can set a motivation for the day. Because I have this perfect situation, you have a perfect human rebirth. Perfect human rebirth. And because I have that perfect situation, okay, I have every ability to become a highly realized being, to become a Buddha. And then I can really benefit all living beings. Start your day, if you like that. See if it brightens up your day. right at the beginning of the day, I am taking the reins of the wild horse in my mind, and I'm directing the energy of my body, speech, and mind where I want it to go, in what direction I want it to go. This is what happens with a lot of people. You wake up in the morning, you're powered and mowed over by your lists and your agenda. All the things you need to do, all the things you, I can't even, you know, and then your mind, and then you turn on your phone. I don't know how many people, how many minutes of the day go by before you turn your phone on? Right? Be honest. Right? How many minutes would you say? When do you turn your phone on? I'm curious.
Immediately.
It's on. It's on. What would happen if you turned it off once in a while?
No alarm.
That's the one thing on retreats now. I will sometimes say, bring an alarm that's not your phone. Because that phone, it's, you know, I'm working with some people that have phone addiction, tech addictions. Grayscale, that's my latest little method, grayscale it. You can turn off the colors on your phone, and it becomes grayscale, black and white phone. It's very different looking at the phone like that. Less succulents of like, I got to go in there. I got to go into the phone world. And okay, I turn my phone off every night, and I have usually a day a week, a tech holiday. Nothing gets turned on, right? I have a landline at the house, so if my siblings, if there's some emergency, they can reach me like that. But one time there was a death in the family of somebody close in the family, and it took them half a day to reach me because I was living across the world from them, and about half a day to even get the message to me because my phone was unplugged. The landline, I used to unplug it in Vajrapani. And still they reach me in enough time to, you know, like you'll get the message. Somehow somebody will reach you. Because we always say, in case of emergency. So maybe why don't you try another alarm if you like? Or, so let's say the phones are always on. How quickly do you start engaging with it other than the alarm? How quickly would you say, generally? What's that?
1 hour.
In 1 hour? Okay, 1 hour. She gives herself an hour before she picks it up. Some people said immediately. Some people aren't mentioning. Don't want to mention. It varies. Isn't it interesting? Right? So the immediate folks, you know, you grab it and then there you are. You haven't even set a motivation for the day and you're lost in phone land. And look how it distracts you. Look how it suddenly ding, 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 ricochet. Okay. Doesn't the internet is an amazing place, I find. There's some incredible benefits of the internet and being wired in. Okay. The other day, it's Friday, a week ago today, I did a Zoom teaching for 2 hours to Rio, Brazil. My girlfriend, a nun friend of mine, wonderful. She is, running the center. She asked if I could, do a teaching. Can I come down? And I have so much travel this year, I couldn't do another flight like that. And so she goes, we'll do a Zoom call. And they had their center like this, people in the center. She put it out online, so there were people watching elsewhere, tuned in, some of them in Florida and things like that. And for me, it was so exciting because there I was in my childhood bedroom, right? Just home, right, with a Zoom thing. So the benefits of technology and the internet, and yet what I also find is the internet brings your awareness into a little tiny space, this, only to scatter it in a million different directions, right? So be skillful about that. I like to get my mind oriented in a positive way at the beginning of the day, and I find when I don't, the day sometimes I'm like this. So any time of the day you can come back. A little 1 to 2 minute gratitude and motivation. Anytime you forgot the motivation because you didn't have a habit of it yet, that's okay. You got into the bathroom and you saw your note and you go, then do it right then. You can even do it while you're brushing your teeth. Think about, you know, it's nice to do it quietly and stuff, but you can do it when you're going through some morning activities if you're late or you have to get off to work like that. But see if it better balances you, sets you off in a more positive direction, contributes to having more joy. Precious Human Rebirth. So I just want to weave in, I said I'd weave in a little bit of the Lam Rim teachings. A lot of you are familiar with these preliminary. This is like very beginning Lam Rim. Lam Rim is our path. Lam is path. Rim, stages, as you know. Stages of the path is our underlying philosophy. Okay? Perfect Human Rebirth, I just want to review a bit, and you're familiar, and I'll see how much you remember, because we have to hear it again and again. There are 18 situations that traditionally make up what's called a perfect or precious human rebirth. This is the foundation that, and it is this teaching and these meditations, okay, that lead tremendous joy to your life and balance a mind that gets stuck in anxiety and depression. Incredible. And people that suffer from low self-esteem, this is the meditation you need to do. Number one would be gratitude, that appreciation. But there's 18 situations that traditionally make up a precious human rebirth according to Lam Rim teachings. 8 freedoms and 10 richnesses or endowments. 8 freedoms, what do you remember? What are the 8 freedoms? What situations are you free from? Sorry?
Hunger?
8 freedoms? Hunger. You've studied this. Come on.
Yeah, I forgot.
Okay. See, no, that's why it's good to repeat. Not hunger. Hunger's not one of them, but thank you.
You can understand Dharma.
Please?
You can understand Dharma.
So I would call that... That's an endowment. 8 freedoms. Let's go back to the 8 freedoms. This is why it's good to review. 8 freedoms. Let me give you a hint. There's 4 situations we're free from, 4 other realms. What are those realms? We're free from being a hell being. Thank you. That's number 1. We're free from being a hungry ghost. Number 2. Preta realm. We're free from being an animal. Those are the 3 lower realms of existence. Thank you, God, you are free from that. You are not in those realms. Okay? And you're free from number 4, being in a God realm. God, there's 2 God realms. They are, they're basically characteristic of being in enormously pleasurable situations. You're not enlightened in those realms. Okay? Now you go, well, what's the matter with enormous pleasure? Why is that a problem? When I got into Dharma and I heard about the one of the main God realms, I was like, I'm headed there. Hedonism. Total hedonism. The other God realm is more jealous. They're jealous of the hedonistic gods. So they have a lot of jealousy. But the hedonistic gods, I thought, well, that sounds great. Not great. Because what happens is all you have is pleasure. You use up a considerable amount of merit and positive conditions to get enlightened. So you tend to leave there and end up in a lower realm from there. But because it's only pleasurable with no suffering, you have no incentive to want to practice Dharma. Okay? Human realm, perfect. You have a balance of leisure and a balance of suffering. Suffering motivates you to want to get out of this mess, and the leisure affords you the time to practice, to learn how to get out of this mess. So we're free from those 4 situations. We're also free from being born at a time that a Buddha didn't exist. Okay? There's other eons, other time periods, no Buddha. No Buddha comes. A place, we're free from being in a place with no Dharma. Saudi Arabia, it's illegal to practice Dharma. Okay? That's not the United States of America. So how fortunate that I landed in this country where I'm free to practice. Okay? We're free from being born with defective senses. People that are deaf, people that are blind, they can read books with Braille, they can try to understand and read the teachings, but they can't get the oral transmission of them. And some teachings, to really have it penetrate more deeply, you need, they say, ear-whispered teachings from the teacher's lips to your ears. Either in person or live streaming apparently counts. Seriously, we've checked. Because people, we've asked Lama Zopa Rinpoche, can I get the initiation or the empowerment by listening to the recording? And he said no. But when it's live streamed, it's different because it's happening right then into your consciousness. But recordings are slightly different, apparently.
So we've checked, because technology's come into the Dharma, and so now people check those things. It's still great to listen to recordings. You get so much out of it, but if you're trying to teach something, you technically should have gotten taught it before and heard it from the teacher's mouth to your ears. That's how we have an oral tradition. That's what it's called, oral tradition passed down. You're also free. The last of the eight freedoms is you are free from holding wrong views. Wrong view on one level would be, you know, in the early 20th century, people were not clear about the effects of smoking tobacco, the negative effects on your body. And so now if you thought that smoking cigarettes would not harm you, that's holding a wrong view. If you want to relate it to Dharma teachings, saying that I don't know why His Holiness the Dalai Lama talks about death and impermanence, I think I'm going to live forever in this body, I think that's garbage what they're talking about. That's holding a wrong view. Like that. It's different than being discerning about the teachings. If you say, I'm not sure about reincarnation, I'm just going to put it on the shelf over here for the time being and go to these teachings that I do like, that's different. That's healthy to be discerning. And you should please thoroughly check up everything I'm talking about and see, is it accurate? Does it work for my mind? Like that. Very helpful. Okay. So we're free from being born in a hell realm, free from being a preta, free from being an animal, free from being a god, free from being born at a time when a Buddha didn't exist, free from being in a place with no Dharma, free from having defective senses, sense faculties. Also, people that are mentally incapacitated cannot practice Dharma. It's very difficult. And free from holding wrong views. The ultimate wrong view is not having a direct perception of emptiness or the nature of reality. Like that. And that really prevents you from experiencing the big joy. Like that. Okay, then there's 10 endowments or richnesses. 5 are environmental and 5 are personal. Personal endowments. You are a human. Okay? You're born in, and the way they literally say it, in the center of a religious country. Okay? And that means a place you can practice Dharma. Okay? You're born with a well-functioning body and mind. You also have not committed the 5 heinous crimes. These are the 5 heinous crimes. Killing your mother, killing your father, killing an arhat. An arhat is one who has reached nirvana. Drawing blood from a Buddha with intent to harm and causing a schism in a spiritual community. Those are the 5 worst things you can do. If you've done those in this life, you cannot get enlightened in the same lifetime, but you can purify anything. It doesn't mean you want to do those things because you can purify later. You want to avoid those things at any expense. But then in future lives, you can certainly get enlightened like that. You're also, the other personal endowment is you have faith in the Dharma. So now not everybody has the same level of faith. And faith, I would say, for a lot of Westerners is very challenging. We don't quite have that built-in faith and devotion that I've seen from my Asian sisters and brothers. And I've learned a lot from them about that. So, but we develop faith. We develop faith. And, but, so for some reason you're here tonight, I'd say, for instance, you're affiliated with this center because you've developed some faith in the teachings, some faith in the teachers that come through and some faith in this path, like that. Those are the 5 personal endowments. Environmental endowments, circumstantial endowments you have. You're born in, they say, a fortunate period when a Buddha has appeared. So again, this relates to the freedom of I'm free from being at a time when there's no Buddha. So they relate to each other. Born, again, a fortunate period when a Buddha has appeared. Number 2 of the circumstantial, the Buddha, fortunate period when the Buddha taught. Okay? Number 3, a fortunate period, I exist, when the Dharma exists and flourishes. Look at this center. You have Kadampa Center. with this beautiful stupa outside and wonderful teachers and Geshe Gelek, and you know, it's fantastic. And there's, you're born, number four, in a fortunate period when we're able to meet pure followers of Buddha's teachings. That's often referring to monks and nuns like that, could be more specifically like that. And the last is you're born in a fortunate period when practitioners can enjoy kind support. So the only reason this center exists and flourishes is because of all of you and all the people and all the members and all the people and donors that contribute to this center. The only reason I'm here is because there's sponsors that have helped me get here, that are hosting me, that are offering the food and the plane ticket, and a friend of mine bought the plane ticket. And yeah, I mean, it's amazing that people contribute and volunteer and all these kind of things for the centers and try to support monks and nuns and things like that. 10 endowments, okay? 8 freedoms, 10 endowments. Time to learn them, okay? It's neat. But so they make up a precious human rebirth. And what you can do, and what's really helpful, and what people I find so much are leaving out of their practices, is to do analytical meditation on the Lam Rim. Analytical meditation on the Lam Rim. Students hear it and they go, oh, I'll do all these other mantras or these other things, but they'll go, it's boring. What we mean is analytical meditation on the Lam Rim, whether you have 10 or 20 minutes a day, you know, you're reading a Lam Rim prayer, you stop at a verse, and on the side in your life, you've studied a little bit, read a little bit, highlighted in a book, outlined, what is it I'm supposed to meditate on with that verse, Precious Human Rebirth. You can take a prayer, the foundation of all good qualities, it's in this book. And the second verse is about precious human rebirth. This rebirth that is found but once, is difficult to obtain, is easily lost. All right, and I read the verse, stop, pause, okay, only the second verse of the Lam Rim prayer, and I'm going to choose one or two of the leisures, the freedoms, and endowments, and meditate on those. Okay, I'm going to choose, today I'm going to do, I'm free from being an animal. Free from being an animal. What do I do? Close your eyes, you get into your meditation posture, choose an animal, be the animal. What's it like to walk around like your cat? Fur all over your body, low to the ground. What do you eat as a cat? Personally, I find cat food disgusting. Okay? Think about how it smells. How do you clean yourself? Okay. Notice the cat. First of all, you say your cat's really intelligent. Okay? There's no cats in here right now that have come to the Dharma teaching. They don't have the ability to understand the Dharma. I know. I've lived with many cats. They seem to be in, you know, highly evolved in deep samadhi, but I'm still trying to find out the purpose of cats, right? But you really have to look out through their eyes, 10 or 20 minutes, as concentrated as you can. That's how you do analytical meditation, is check their lives. I notice cats, they get completely freaked out when a pot falls off the thing. Now, I know it's a pot that fell on the ground. It's like, oh, yeah, okay. And they run into the other room, their eyes like this, killing animals, killing rats and mice and things like that. They don't know any better, like that, clawing up your sofa. And, going outside and then eating a large wood rat that was way too much for them to eat, gulping down the entire thing, and then very happily coming back into my house and vomiting up in the middle of the living room carpet. Cats, okay? Be the cat for 10 or 20 minutes, but or anything. Choose any animal. But you need to put your mind in that. And any time you really get a moment in this analytical meditation that, oh, my God, this is awful. This is awful. Place your concentration on that feeling. I am free from this. I am free from this rebirth. Or when you come back into your current life at the end of the meditation and you feel that sense of relief, place your concentration on that. That's how we combine shine, or calm abiding meditation, with analytical meditation on the Lam Rim. That's how you combine shine and analytical meditation. It's very effective for moving your mind, okay, for gaining realizations of the Lam Rim, which really shift your mind for the better. You want to take, I'm going to meditate one day, freedom from being born when at a time when a Buddha didn't exist. You really want to penetrate, go into that in your mind. There's no Buddha. There was no Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha did not exist. There was no Indian prince who got enlightened. Okay, that means no Kadampa Center. No Kadampa Center. So I wouldn't have the joy of knowing you guys, people that I wouldn't have met you guys. I wouldn't be a Buddhist nun. I might be, God forbid, still working in politics. I'd rather hang myself, right? Can you imagine? There would be no stupa in this corner. This would be something else. This building would be something entirely different. There would be no Dalai Lama, no Lama Zopa Rinpoche, no Light of the Path retreat. Right? It would be hard to know what methods you'd have. There's other spiritualities of what would I do when I have problems and what kind of meditation would I be doing if there wasn't Buddhist meditation? There are other meditations, but there wouldn't be Buddhist meditations. Wouldn't be any of those books that are out there in the library. None of that would exist if it's Buddhist. So you'd spend some time from every angle really exploring over and over. That's analytical meditation coming from that's what you want your ruminating mind to focus on, is that. Use your ruminating mind like that. Over and over and over. Oh my God, I can't believe it. And I'm free. I'm not living in a world like that. I'm free from being in a time when a Buddha didn't exist. How wonderful. And then you drink in that gratitude when you feel that deeper experience of it. So when you place your shine, your calm abiding, the focus of your meditation there, the concentration, when I get that juicy feeling, it deepens the realization. Okay, then feel that gratitude. We know how to do analytical meditation. We just don't do it on the right things. Right? We ruminate on the wrong things. Somebody's negative, someone you don't like, their negative qualities. So that convinces you that they're a jerk, right? Is that helpful? Not really helpful. Okay. And then what's neat to go on with Precious Human Rebirth is the usefulness, what you can do with the rebirth, okay, but how difficult it is to get this rebirth. We think we got here once. Oh, I'm at Kadampa Center. People say, oh, well, you're a nun. You'll take a good rebirth. I don't know that. You don't know what's in my mind, right? Okay. But we try. So the difficulty of obtaining this precious human rebirth. So they give examples. One example is you take a straight pin. You know the pin that has the little teeny little top on it? The straight pin. You dip the straight pin in honey. Okay? And then you dip it. If you go to the beach, you dip it like the Outer Banks and you dip it in sand. The amount of sand that clings to the top of that pin compared to all the sand granules on the entire planet, that's a precious human rebirth. That's how rare it is. So you'd meditate over and over on that. You know, you're like, wow. So the one I had, this is the example they give, is the blind sea turtle. Have you heard this one? Blind sea turtle. We hear this again and again. I didn't get it. I couldn't hear it anymore about the blind sea turtle. Didn't work for me at all. I'm like, what? Okay. You know how vast the waters are, the seas of the world. There's a blind sea turtle. And it only comes up to the surface to get air once every 100 years. Okay? And on the surface of the seas is floating a golden yolk, like a lifesaver, with a hole in the middle. Just floating around. What are the chances when the blind sea turtle surfaces once every 100 years for it to get its head through the yolk? That's a precious human rebirth. Those are the odds. Very, very rare. So you'd want to sit with that. So finally I was in a longer retreat and I was like, I got to get this blind sea turtle happening. Like, I don't get it at all. I hate that meditation. I'm like, Never got it. Didn't. So I just kind of stayed for a long time with the seas of the world, because I really like ocean. I love swimming in the ocean, even though Rinpoche recently said, I'm sure it was just for me, I love swimming in the ocean. It's one of my favorite things to do. Warm ocean, sorry. Warm ocean. Be specific, you know. And Rinpoche was talking about it at some retreat I was in, I think in France this year, last year, and he said, yeah, and then people always want to go swimming in the ocean, and then they come back as a fish. So I'll be thinking about that the next time I want to swim in the ocean. And I used to come to the Outer Banks a lot years ago when I lived in Washington, D.C. So I got into the ocean for a long time of, like, it was pretty vast. And then I was like, wow, for that turtle to come up and get its head, you know, like, it worked for me from that. I really realized, like, wow, that's never going to happen again. So what it does is you really want to grab this life right now. You want to use this life as meaningfully, as wisely, as usefully as you can, directed on your spiritual practice, because that's the thing that will benefit you. That's the thing that will have going on in your mind into future lives, if you believe in that, like that. So it's really helpful to do these meditations. So I wanted to add that in about precious human rebirth. Oh my God, it's 9 o'clock. Okay. Any other questions, comments about that? Please. Yes. And one time, just a funny story, we have centers all over Mexico, and I've taught there many times. And one of the guys, it was on the island of Cozumel, we have a center. And the man that was running it at the time, or his wife was running it, he had a dive shop before, and he kept every day, I was there for, I don't know, a couple of weeks, he kept saying, you know, you should go diving. You should go, you know, I've never done scuba diving, but he really wanted me to go, and he kept insisting, you can snorkel, you know, because I wasn't licensed to dive, but he kept pushing, and finally, and actually, Geshe-la went there, he taught there, and then I think he thought, you know, I was feeling like I was a nun, I shouldn't be doing that, and then he looked at me and he goes, Geshe-la went. So then I said, well, if Geshe-la went, you know, okay, like I'll, you know. So he took me out on a boat, a few people, you know, a number of people, and I was snorkeling on the surface, and in order to do that out at sea, they had to tie a lifesaver to my ankle with a rope, like a yoke. It was a big orange thing. Okay? But it was like, you know, it was a long rope, so I it didn't obstruct me, but it was tied to me so people would see me. The other boats would know there's somebody swimming. So I'm cruising along, you know, I love the water. You put me in the water, I'm, you know, off I go. And I'm just having a really great time, and there's my yoke, and here comes a sea turtle right in front of me. You know, it didn't look blind, but I was like, you know, I was like, is he gonna get, you know, like suddenly. I mean, it's nice if you're doing a regular activity, our normal, everyday, mundane activities like that, but then my mind could be reminded of the Dharma. Like, that's what came up, and suddenly I remembered my precious human rebirth, you know. Like, to, you know, to have the gratitude to realize, and to say to myself at that time, okay, I'm having a little leisure recreation right now, and then, but when I go back and they take me back, then I'm going to finish my practice tonight and make sure I'm not, you know, wasting too much time like that. We need some downtime like that to create joy like that. So, please, question.
Well, this is, I guess it's kind of a comment. The 8 freedoms and the 10 richnesses talk about you have use of all your senses and therefore you can hear the teachings. And I just think, well, what if you were born deaf? Are you just doomed? And then likewise, you have a well-functioning body and mind. And again, I think I know people who don't have all their limbs or, you know, had polio, so they weren't born that way. But, you know, I'm like, what do they think if they were to read this?
Yep.
Do they just think?
Well, partly well-functioning body and mind. Let me read. That's how it's one of the definitions here is, I more would relate that, like when you said about being deaf. So what happens with, there was a woman that came to our center that told us in advance, I have a hearing problem. Okay? So she had some kind of device she worked with, and we really tried to make it happen for her. We got a special speaker. We got her right next to the speaker. She still couldn't hear. Lama Zopa Rinpoche was teaching. And so there are disadvantages because of that. So she missed the entire teaching, which, so sometimes that happens. Losing a limb, I don't think, is an issue. You can still practice Dharma. So it wouldn't be related to a loss of a limb or something like that. But the deafness really, and she said it's really been a problem for her. She can't be at live Dharma teaching. She has to read the transcript later. And often the transcripts aren't done at all. You know, people aren't transcribing or, so that could be a disadvantage. I've also met, and Lama Yeshe was very serious about this, that Dharma centers are not for the mentally ill. People have some idea that, oh, you know, it's really good for mentally ill people to go to the Dharma Center. The Dharma Center will take care of them. We're not mental health facilities. And you need to have pretty good mental grounding to practice Dharma, or you can go crazy. And I've seen mentally ill people, retreat centers in particular, are magnets for mentally ill people. I've had to deal with many, many, many that have come to our centers. So we make a deal depending on how ill they are. People would show up at a 10-day retreat, and 10-day retreat or 1-month retreat, a group retreat, and they come to the Dharma Center, and this is a really great time for me to stop taking my meds because I'm at the Dharma Center. It's just all about meditation. I've heard them say this to me. And so we've had arrangements where I had to sit down with them very directly. The meditation leader or the teacher of the course sat down, and we privately discussed with them and said, you're welcome to join the retreat, and you need to stay on your meds. And if we have any inkling at all that you're not taking them and there's any behavior indicative of that, you will be asked to leave immediately. So do you understand? Is that clear? And we've had them sign stuff because, and then it's worked out well where they are like, I've got it. And because there's a container, and a lot of mentally ill people need direct boundaries. This is where the line is. And then it's worked pretty well, but generally, long-term-wise, if they're really ill, it hasn't worked out been my experience. Short-term, it's certainly been able to do. But it can be, you know, very challenging like that. So I think that's what they mean, like that. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anything else? So you have your practice in the morning if you choose. I'd love to know, how does it work? How do you feel about it? What happens if you forget it? What will help remind you to do it? That's a great thing, is figure out the tricks for yourself of reminders and ways that I can start habituating my mind with something that could be positive. And I'd like to also just in closing dedicate the merit, whatever positive energy we've created. So we're going to turn to the gold prayer books, please. Page 235. There's 3 verses we're going to read. And I'd like to invest and fold in all the whatever positive energy we've created from this time together, can we invest it in our practices that will not only help us develop more joy in our lives and in our practices, but will lead us to full enlightenment so we can be of the most benefit to all living beings. Let's read these in English. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantabhadra too realize things as they are, I too dedicate all these merits in the best way that I may follow their perfect example. And page 244, the long life prayers for His Holiness, the Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa Rinpoche. 244. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. I'd also like to dedicate for all the beings in the Australia fires. May those fires be extinguished immediately. May people be able to rebuild their lives. May those who've perished immediately take a precious human rebirth to benefit, to get enlightened, to benefit all. And for the coronavirus to be contained instantly and for the spread to stop and people to be healed. I'd also like to dedicate to Jack Sonnenbaum, who is a dear friend of mine, who is part of our Buddhist community in California, who passed away a few days ago of cancer. He and his wife were always hosting all like monks and nuns at their house and Dharma practitioners for years and helping all of our communities in California. We can direct some energy to him and anyone else who needs additional healing. Thank you very much. So we're back at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming. And if you'd like any more info about the pilgrimage, if you want to take a card, it's on my website. There's detailed itinerary like that. Feel free.